And this is the Dead TV Podcast, and I am your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Seneca.
And tonight's episode of Dead TV Podcast is Blood Moon Rising, the second to last episode of the Kindred Embraced television show, which I just noticed, by the way, now on IMDb, is listed as 1996 till it doesn't say it ended. Most canceled television shows or most television series that have had official endings do list the beginning and end dates. This does not.
This episode in particular was actually aired on May the 1st, 1996. So, Bad Moon Rising. A rogue Nosferatu has reverted to the clan's ancient monstrosus form and steals a baby for its blood to gain enormous power in order to defeat Daedalus and lead the Nosferatu clan to rise up against Julian. The two square off, and Julian must fight for his life. In the search for the baby, Caitlin reveals her deepest secret and becomes lovers with Julian.
I want to point out that the director of this episode, James L. Conway, has a extensive career in Hollywood going all the way back to 1976 with a documentary called In Search of Noah's Ark, and going all the way until 2017 with episodes still yet to air from the TV series Magicians on Sci-Fi Channel.
And if any of you film buffs are listening, take a listen at the commentary for this episode, because it is entirely about actually the process of which the shots were taken and how the industry works for filming an episodical presentation like this. It's really interesting. It doesn't have much to do with the talk of vampires, but it's very interesting if you're actually getting into filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. This guy, this filmmaker, this director, he has directed everything from Star Trek Voyager, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Star Trek Enterprise, Star Trek The Next Generation. I mean, this guy has worked in every single Star Trek television series with the exception of the original, Smallville, Supernatural. He worked on 125 episodes of Charmed. Was he a producer?
He was the
producer of 125 episodes of Charmed.
He was also the director for episode number 5, Live Hard, Die Young, and Leave a Good-Looking Corpse.
Yes, this guy has definitely a man in demand for Hollywood. For Supernatural, related to my other podcast, he directed one of my favorite episodes, The Real Ghostbusters, where Sam and Dean go to a supernatural convention and they cannot believe it. So why don't we go through the episode synopsis, Mistress Zeneca?
All right. Well, I already read it. The synopsis.
Oh, sorry. I meant, okay, hold on one second. Let me just find where I just fucked up and then pause it.
This episode opens up with Julian meeting with his editors. And he's not meeting at the paper. It's actually meeting at his house. So Julian is talking to them about paper sales and about sensationalism. So in order to slyly get away from the stories like, you know, girl dies in hospital, wakes up, jumps out window, or, you know, the blood brother killer, you know, instead of actually sensationalizing all these crimes, Julian says he wants the paper to focus on the actual work being done by the police forces and the good that they're doing to keep the community safe.
Yes.
Seems like a very honorable way of running the paper. He says that he doesn't care about the paper sales, but that he wants to keep it, you know, high. So he's like, he wants to go high, not go low. You know, be more top of the line with the editing and reporting versus the gore and, you know, trying to just make a buck off of the sensationalized headlines.
In translation, stop writing stories about kindred activities and start writing stories about non-kindred activities.
Exactly.
This thing called the masquerade, you suck at it, Julian, by banging your editor and owning a newspaper where you should be diverting every single story away from kindred crap into human crap, okay? There's probably enough. It's San Francisco, all right? There's enough crimes going on in San Francisco that you can write about them without involving your precious kindred. You are a terrible prince. Yes, no wonder Asimites fucking kill you, by the way. Yeah, that's a spoiler for the box set if you happen to buy it.
So, you know, after
we love
this
you,
movie,
Mark Frankel. Rest in peace.
Yeah. Wonderful actor.
Yes.
So after the meeting with the editors, Caitlin and Julian are just talking, and it's a little flirty or whatnot, but they're talking, and Lily walks in with a whole vase of roses, like a major cock block, and, you know, Caitlin says, oh, I wasn't expecting to see you here, and like, oh, me? I live here. And the look on Julian's face was like, oh my god, you just did not say that.
Yeah, Caitlin, of course, has no idea what type of arrangement they have. I mean, she has to be a stupid reporter not to figure out that Julian has multiple partners.
Yeah.
I mean, but even if you're not a Kindred, you should be able to completely figure out that two people are banging.
Yeah, definitely chemistry. And every time it's referred to as like, oh, we had a relationship a long time ago. A long time ago, you guys just ended your relationship officially last episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, because of the complete betrayal that Lily did to Julian, with basically siding with the Brujas in her heated, passionate moodiness. Like, in her moodiness, she sided with the Bruja and almost got him killed. She thought he was killed, and so they broke up based on that, as you would. But every time in this episode is referred to their relationship as it happened a long time ago and that they're just friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that it's a fresh wound. But in that scene, like, she's walking in with that vase of roses and putting them down, and completely was a cock block. Completely. It's like, oh, I'm going to stick myself right in between you guys because I don't like the idea that you two are banging.
Oh, yeah.
You know, even if they aren't.
Yeah. Yeah. Give it to the end of the episode.
Yeah. So the next scene, it goes to the major plot line of the episode, is that this teenager, the 17-year-old Ruth, basically single mother, taking her baby Jessie, a little girl, out to the park. So this is a Golden Gate Park, right near the Golden Gate Bridge. It's a pretty nice little park, but the actual scene was filmed at the L.A. Arboretum.
Mm-hmm.
So it has nothing to do with the actual Golden Gate Park. I've been there, and I didn't recognize it. So it was filmed at the L.A. Arboretum. But so she's playing with her baby, and her baby starts crying, and then she leaves the baby on the grass to go to her car, which is about 50 feet away. And leaving the baby like that, no one's around, so it seems safe. But she turns her back, and someone is there stealing her baby. And she runs up, goes to grab the bassinet, the carrier that she has Jessie in, and Nosferatu face, like, hissing at her with these lizard eyes, and she freaks out, and they run off, and she runs after them, and then they're gone. Completely gone. You know, because that's what the Nosferatu do. They can disappear. So she's, you know, completely beside herself. She doesn't know what to do. She's calling out for her daughter and nothing. So, of course, she goes to the police.
Mm-hmm.
And she meets with Frank. And, you know, the Frank is being hounded by another reporter. And immediately she says that a monster took her baby. And, you know, that makes you sound like a crazy person. You know, it says that he's got eyes like a lizard, the kidnapped baby. The sketch artist starts to do a drawing of this guy, and he's like, no, balder, like, he had no hair, absolutely no hair. And then the eyes, no, they were like lizard eyes, blazing eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And the ears are pointed. And every single one of these things, like, you're thinking, if you didn't know that it was a Nosferatu, you'd think she was completely insane.
Correct. I'm reminded of an episode of Spider-Man the Animated Series when Morbius the Living Vampire attacks college student classmate of Peter Parker's. She basically describes the exact same way, and she says, and it had fangs, and the cops looks at her, fangs? I'm totally serious about this. And he's just like, all right, you're the crazy woman. So he starts drawing fangs into the he's like, look, it's just like that. Looked like a and then it cuts to the news reporter. A vampire is stalking ACASU, and Spider-Man's involved.
While Frank is taking this report, there's a scene with Caitlin and Julian, you know, getting hot and heavy again, and then Caitlin pulls away, and, you know, she's apologizes that she can't go all the way with him. And, you know, what is she, like, in her 30s? And she's having some issues with actually having sex, you know, being able to trust someone to have sex. So, you know, there's a story there, but we're not going to get to it just yet.
Mm-hmm.
So he's, Julian, being a vampire, he's extremely patient. You know, he's got all the time in the world, literally. So he can wait for her to, you know, warm up to him, you know, years if it takes. I don't think he would lose interest, but she apologizes and, you know, words are said, and it's okay, it's okay. You know, whenever it's good for you. The next scene is we're basically getting kind of a background on what's going on here. So the Nosferatu clan, once the bomb was dropped, saying that there was a kidnapped baby, and this is the police artist sketch. Julian immediately, like, you know, he turns his face away a little bit and almost that realizing look like, oh shit, it's one of my guys. So we see the Nosferatu clan, and do we see them at that point? Well, we see them later.
Yeah, we see them later.
Later, but
it's mostly focusing on Goth and Camilla.
Yeah, Goth is his name.
Goth, what a dumbass name.
I know.
God, seriously, even when I was 19 years old, the first time I watched this episode, because I did not watch them when they aired, I watched them on VHS, I was just always like, Goth? What? Who the fuck wrote this name?
I honestly did not, I could not put it through my brain that they actually named the character Goth, so I kept hearing Garth. Garth, until someone later in the episode actually really, you know, slowly pronounced it. I'm like, Goth. Oh, they totally did that. I'm like, it was like a face slapping moment. Like, oh my god, Garth was bad, but Goth is even worse.
The actor who plays Goth is played by Skip Suddoth, who has a long one of those kind of careers. Who's just in a lot of things, NCIS, NCIS New York, NCIS this, that, and the other thing. Directing of episodes. He was in 6 episodes of Oz. He was in like 3 episodes of 24. You know, 24 is kind of like one of those shows that you don't just appear in one episode. If you got a walk-on part, you appear like in 3 episodes because three hours within a single day. He was in a movie, Ronin. He was on Louie. He was on Third Watch. And then the woman who plays Camilla, Patricia Charbonnier, she was in Manhunter, and She's All That, Hollywood Hope and Lies, but hasn't done anything since 2008. But Hollywood Hope and Lies is some recently announced project of hers. She's been in several episodes of Law and Order, Walker Texas Ranger. She is only because I just watched this movie the other day with somebody who had never seen it. Don't ask me why, but we watched RoboCop 2, and she's a technician that works on RoboCop in a very kind of like on scene, like tinkering with him, writes something on a clipboard, and then walks away. And I looked at her and go, wait a minute. I recognize that not bald woman.
Not bald.
Give her some fangs. Wait a minute. I know her now.
Yeah. So Julian talks to all the primogens and is, you know, trying, except of course for Eddie Fiore, because he has passed on. He has ceased to be. And the Brujas are still fighting over who's going to be the next primogen, so there's not a Bruja primogen at the table. The idea is that they're going to use the baby for blood magic. They're going to drain the baby of his blood for the blood magic, and that's going to revert them to a more powerful, more sinister, more savage form of Nosferatu. So they have a pretty good idea that this is happening. Julian sends the gang girls and Cash in this almost like Godfather-esque scene. You know, everyone's at the table and it has the stark light on them, and Daedalus's face is really washed out to, you know, portray that sickly Nosferatu coloring.
Mm-hmm.
And then Julian talks to Frank. And there's an argument over whether this is a human crime or a vampire crime. because it's a missing kid, which is technically like the human crime department, but the perpetrator is a vampire. With what has to be portrayed in the news and in the newspaper and the police reports, they have a police sketch of this Nosferatu that no one will believe is actually the suspect. So they're suspecting Ruth, the mother, of actually killing her baby. Because, of course, the closest people in any crime are the first suspects, whether it's the wife or husband or the parents or children. You know, whoever's closest is more than likely a perpetrator, so she is suspecting a suspect. Ruth is a suspect. So Julian asks Frank for more time because he's saying that it's a vampire crime and he'll take care of it. And Frank is saying, no, this is my territory, I'll take care of it. But really, what could Frank do to a powerful Nosferatu? Really?
Mm-hmm.
You know? I think if I were in Frank's shoes, I would want as much of this vampire work out of my house, so I wouldn't have to deal with it. But yet there's a police file that he has to handle inside the department. So that's you know, is this this jurisdiction or that jurisdiction? And so Julian sends Cash and the gang girls to really you know, track him down and to find them. So they're pretty sure that it's Goth and Camilla. And Camilla is actually a very beautiful Nosferatu, in my opinion. But they have a secret lair somewhere near the Golden Gate Park or in the Golden Gate Park that Cash is trying to find. So when Julian goes back to he goes back to the police department and sees Ruth. He gives this look to Ruth that seems as if he's trying to persuade her, but it never really follows through. And I'm not sure if that was a mistake or it's on purpose, because he's saying how they're gonna find the baby and really Caitlin is talking to her after that. Julian has walked off, and I don't know what he's trying to persuade her for, and it doesn't really look like something happened later.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was more of a, you know, shut the fuck up. Yeah. Because she's, you know, going off about a monster and a monster.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a shut the fuck up, but it's not really followed through. It's just kind of a look. It seems out of place, but...
By the way, was the do you think the interaction between Julian and Frank is the closest to the bromance that we're going to get for the episode?
I think so. I think so because, well, no. I think the bromance portion is later in the episode when Daedalus actually feeds his blood to Julian in the form of a wine glass.
Oh, that's right.
That's a pretty deep bromance to take in someone else's blood. So it wasn't lovey-dovey or you know, palsy-wowsy, but it was certainly a powerful gesture. Huh?
Palsy-wowsy.
And Daedalus is imparting his power over to Julian. And so I think that was the bromance portion of the episode. This scene with Frank and Julian, it comes close. Like, they're trying to negotiate on whose job is this. But I really think Daedalus and him have a closer relationship in this episode. So, okay. Caitlin meets up with Ruth and talks. You know, talks about the relationship with, you know, the father of Jesse, the baby. And to just kind of get a little bit of background and get to know this character. It's you know, character building at this point in time. You know, Caitlin is talking with Ruth at the police department after Julian left, and Ruth talks about her decision to have the baby, and that everyone was talking about, like, in her family, trying to pressure her into aborting the child, even though in the episode they never use the word abort at all.
But it's basically alluded to.
It's alluded to, you know, that her family was trying to push her into not having the baby. But she was determined to have it, and she says that the baby was the best thing that ever happened to her. You know, she's 17.
Mm-hmm.
So 17-year-olds are ill-equipped to deal with what is actually the best part of their life. But anyway, yeah, it's a child having a child, and, you know, this story touches Caitlin so much. She's got the tears in her eyes, and her eyes have turned red, and she's like, I will help you find your baby. That's a bit of a touching moment between Ruth and Caitlin. And I'm not even sure that Caitlin is really seeing this for a story. Like, she has a story, and that story is up on the board. You know, it's like monster, mother or monster, you know? To which Ruth is, of course, taken offense to,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, she did not kill her baby, yet she's kind of being accused of it on the paper. It's not yet published, nothing's been released about it, but Caitlin is not really digging. She's not doing any sort of journalistic integrity here. It's just, she's hearing this girl's story, and then, without any proof or backup, believes the girl's story. So, one of the things about this blood ceremony that comes up is that it's discovered that Goth has actually transported the Stones of Renassus to the Golden Gate Park. And so Cash finds the place where the Nosferatu Goth and Camilla are hiding away. Yeah. And these Stones of Renassus form almost a circle, almost a perfect circle, with a stone altar in the center for the sacrificial person.
Now this is where we're getting into some deeply religious things with this, with the kindred, in time for the series to get canceled.
So it takes the full moon to really power this blood ritual.
Mm-hmm.
So the baby is relatively safe until the apex of the full moon. So they know that they have very little time. At this point in the story, it's like 31 hours until the full moon, and they need to find this baby too sweet. You know, the baby will be killed, and then the Nosferatu will rise up and, rise up against Julian and really take on the world.
Yeah, because the Nosferatu are at war with the Ventru and everyone else. Isn't Daedalus the primogen of the Nosferatu clan, or am I missing something here?
No, he's totally the primogen. And when Goth rides into town, he's riding on this, if you'll excuse the expression, populist wave of support from his Nosferatu kin.
Oh, really? Who are you referencing in this very subtle, sarcastic tone of voice, Mr. Zeneca?
It's not obvious.
Anyone in particular in a big house with small hands? Tiny, softish fingers, constantly parried on Saturday Night Live by one of the greatest living actors of our generation.
So, Goth, he is completely talking about making the Nosferatu clan great again. Like, we're going to get our power back, we're going to live on the surface again, we're going to make our Nosferatu powerful again, as if today is any comparable to 500 years ago.
Yes, right. Is that how long ago that they were dethroned and became, living in the sewer type people? Is that what they said?
There wasn't a date specifically given, but around about the timeline of how the Ventru and Nosferatu clans emerged onto the U.S.
Okay.
In that area, it seems to be about 500 years, because they do mention... they do mention certain things in the past, and if you notice that the paintings that Daedalus has that show the ritual with the Stones of Renassus,
yep,
also look pretty ancient.
True.
And I know Daedalus himself is quite old. He's the most powerful of them all, and Goth's power at the moment, because of his alchemy and previous blood rituals, has put him pretty much on level with Daedalus, which is kind of nerve-wracking for Daedalus himself, because he is supposed to be the most powerful one and the primogen, and the whole idea that the Nosferatu clan is going to overthrow him because they're going to stand behind someone that says that they're going to make the Nosferatu clan great again with no type of thoughts towards the repercussions that will come.
Oh, like,
Daedalus is saying how, you know, they were hunted to practically extinction, and, you know, do you want the Inquisitions and all of this stuff to happen again? And he's like, no, I don't care. You know, we can control this whole thing. You know, the Ventru, we put them in positions of power in the banks and stuff, and now we're their henchmen.
I gotta wipe tears out of my eyes for a quick second. Somebody has just sent me the video of the Walk of Shame, which is going to become very, very popular soon. Roger Goodell having to walk out on the field with the Vince Lombardi trophy and hand it to the man he suspended for 4 games, Tom Brady,
jeez,
the captain of the New England Patriots in the 51 Super Bowl championship, and everyone in the audience is booing him. They are booing and hissing and calling his name out as he has to walk onto the field with the Vince Lombardi trophy and hand it to the man that he accused and suspended. Yes, like, the fucking irony is absolutely delicious to Patriot fans all over the planet that this jackass, who is as bad as our fucking president, this part will be edited, basically he is the Donald Trump of the National Football League, and he now has to hand the Vince Lombardi trophy to the man he suspended.
Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah.
Which, by the way, when this whole fucking debacle began, Tom Brady won that Super Bowl too, by the way, 3 years ago, and just won 2 years ago, excuse me, in 2015.
Deflategate?
Yes, the Deflategate bullshit. Tom Brady won that fucking Super Bowl in 2015, Goodell, and guess what he just did again? He just won the fucking Super Bowl again. Gee, do you think he did that cheating? Tom Brady did not take the suspension out of admission of guilt. He took it out of just the fucking shit after 2 years of dealing with this crap. Decided to just take a knee. Anyway, back to the topic on hand. Sorry. You don't live in New England, okay? You don't know the shit we've had to go through.
I'm quite insulated from football.
So, basically, they're worried that they're going to bring back the Inquisition and all of the crap and just the bad juju that came with everything.
Yeah, and so Goth is trying to convince all these Nosferatu, and they're eating it up really well.
Yeah, like, let's follow him. Yeah. Rabble.
So the Nosferatu are getting drunk on this idea that they can have this insane amount of power that their clan used to have, both personally for their own abilities, and then also within the greater context of the kindred themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, make the Nosferatu great again. He should have one of those red hats, you know? Red hats.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I don't exactly sure how the drinking of the blood of the innocent baby is going to do that for you, but whatever.
Well, according to the painting that Daedalus has, the full moon shines down, hits the stones a certain way, and directs the flow of light, mm-hmm, I guess it is, from the center sacrifice piece outward in a couple of directions. But if you stand at certain points, I guess you're supposed to absorb it. That part wasn't really so much explained.
Mm-hmm.
But the image is just like the moonlight coming down and directing this energy around the sacrificial altar. Okay, so we get past the Nosferatu scenes with all the really, really excellent makeup. You know, the makeup artist for this episode was Todd Masters. And so that type of makeup on all those people, Nosferatu, that probably took most of the day, actually.
And probably most of their budget.
Yeah, the skull caps, the, you know, the slit eye, contact lenses, the teeth, the gnarly hands. Yeah, they went all out.
How many of these actors do you think actually shaved their head for the episode?
I don't know. On the commentary, they said that they did try to hire actually bald people.
Okay, I didn't watch it with the commentary. Now I need to.
As I said, it's a great commentary just for, you know, how the production is done.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't really lend any information for the actual storylines, but it had a wealth of information on how the productions are done on a, if you're a director for an episode versus a showrunner,
mm-hmm.
and what the responsibilities and the type of atmosphere that you get into and what your day looks like as you're going through this. So it's very interesting, very interesting.
The other thing is and this of course happens at the very end, but since we're talking about the makeup, this is the first time in any of the episodes that we see vampires with fangs.
Yeah.
Julian has fangs. He has upper and lower canines.
Yeah, in the big fight scene at the end, yeah, he really rages out. And I'm not sure if that is part of the addition of Daedalus's blood.
Yeah.
Or if that is part of just the Ventru rage, you know, they're trying to get. But, yeah, his fangs appear. His eyes have, like, these red contacts in. He gets really huge fangs nails, claws. And they actually jump together when they start fighting,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting. So there's some wire work involved with that, too.
Yeah, very pre-Matrix wire work. So this is a 1990... These episodes were probably filmed in late 1995 to get ready for its debut in the spring of 1996. This is still 3 years before The Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
So wire techniques had not become as ridiculous as they are.
Yeah, no, this is very, very small amount. Like, it's when they leap up and they crash together and then they fall to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also during that scene, the sound effects that are being used is amazing. Like, I love the sound effects of the... It's almost like a dogfight. It has growls, it has snarls, it has almost like a lion-ish rumble to it. I don't know who did the Foley work on this, but it is great. It really sounds as if they are tearing each other apart.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, let's see. Also, well, to get back to Ruth here, Ruth and Frank are wandering around the Golden Gate Park, and she has a bear, and she's searching for her daughter, and... I guess just kind of calling out with the bear. It's not like the baby's going to really call out for her or anything, but she's hoping to hear the cry. And,
she's desperate.
And, yeah, just out of desperation. Like, I would be doing the same thing if my son were taken. Like, really, I'd be doing exactly the same things that she's doing. And you can really tell that she is very heartbroken over this, and this is all she can do. Frank takes her to... the diner and feeds her because she's
starving.
Obviously hasn't eaten in a couple of days because out of pure stress and worry and all of that.
Mm-hmm. The diner gets a lot of screen time in this entire show. Do we ever get a name? What's the name of the diner again?
The Nighthawk Diner.
The Nighthawk Diner. Okay. I wonder if that diner actually existed anywhere, or was it, I mean, I'm sure it was probably very cheap to buy a trailer and then turn it into a diner.
No, this was actually a diner.
Oh, it was.
Yeah, it was a diner, and they purchased the diner completely and then just moved it to, like, the parking lot of the set.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually a diner, and they said that it was much cheaper to buy the diner and move it versus creating a diner set from scratch.
This is why it pays to listen to the commentary before you do your own podcast.
Well, that's why you got me.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. Yeah, that's what hosts are supposed to do. One picks up the slack from the other one when he's too busy watching the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl I gave up on.
Which you should have.
Yeah. Let's not mention that. But yay, Patriots. Anyway, so also we get my favorite Kindred waitress, by the way, just known as Waitress, Kimberly Campbell. No real name, but still... I believe, and I think this is the last episode she's in, I believe that she is a Kindred, just because of the looks that she gives.
She does give a lot of looks, and people come into and disappear from her diner as if it's nothing, and she doesn't even pay them any mind.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't like... the other thing is, I love shows that have a diner for a set or an antique store. Don't ask me why, but in my own personal life, if I see a diner or an antique store, I have to stop. You know what I mean? Even if it's just for a cup of coffee. Of course, if I've had too much coffee, I'm not going to just stop at every single one. But yeah. If I see a new diner, I have to stop at it. I have to eat whatever the food is there. I have to taste what America really tastes like. You know
now,
what I mean?
Do you have a go-to item of thing that you'd order?
Well, it's always going to be coffee, first of all, because you got to see what the coffee is going to taste like in that part of America. I will always, if it's breakfast, I will always order whatever their best breakfast menu item is. Otherwise, mm-hmm. if they don't have one, I'll default to their to see how their eggs are.
Okay.
If it's a if it's lunchtime, then I will default to their soup, as long as their soup is maybe homemade. If it's frozen soup from like a bag that they get at a warehouse or whatever, that's not really anything.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'll try maybe one of their sandwiches, depending on you know what they recommend for a sandwich. But mm-hmm. most of the time, diners, it's usually breakfast and just figuring out you know what the best breakfast is. When you think diners, sometimes a lot of times you think of breakfast.
Okay. All right.
So that's always it. And then, like I said, when I go to every time we see an antique store, I just need to explore it because I think antique stores, in my opinion, are. This is now getting a little off track, but antique stores are basically like the ever-changing museum.
Agreed. It's nice to see things that were previously owned from elderly owners. So,
and sometimes they have a history case. Huh? And sometimes they have like a history case filled with like items from like past politicians' elections or previous wars or. I mean, some of these places have, like, Nazi memorabilia, which is, like, hot collector's items and stuff.
They are. What I usually go for at antique stores is old medical oddities and medical tools.
Oh, my. Well, what are we using these for?
You know, actually, I've never used them in a domination type of scene. It's always been in a theatrical type of scene.
Oh, okay. Well, I will come to Pennsylvania and be your victim.
Oh, I'm going to have to rig up like a whole, you know, Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory type of thing.
Yeah, like strap me to the table and then just be like, all right. So like, and then you have your little
electroshock therapy.
Yeah, you know, I've never tried that. I've only seen it in certain type of videos on the internet. But now that you mentioned it and me making a Frankenstein movie, I need to start thinking into that. And considering the woman who's playing Frankenstein might be into that sort of thing, it might be something to consider. But I digress. Yeah, moving on.
Okay. So,
they're at the diner. They leave the diner.
Yes, they leave the diner. And then the scene jumps to Daedalus again. So that's when Daedalus pours two glasses of wine, cuts open his wrist, and drops some blood into the wine. And I think he does it with the express intention of serving it to Julian. Explains that he's been going, that doing the support for Julian will ostracize him from his Nosferatu clan. Which is kind of an odd place to be as Primogen. Is that you want to be the head of your clan and do what they want to do because you're a representative of them. But his loyalty is for Julian. And that very tight respect, loyalty, and giving the blood over to Julian as well is also giving him a sense of his powers. And since Daedalus is a very powerful Nosferatu, it's giving Julian some boosts to combat. It might be a +3 to his stats. Julian considers Daedalus a close friend and confidant, and he just downs that glass of wine. I'm not sure if he realized what was in it, but there's like 50-50 when I was watching this. I was thinking, does Julian think that it's poisoned or that he used alchemy? Or that his blood is in it, or that it's just a regular glass of wine. But he downs it, a full glass of wine in basically one go.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were just having a glass of wine with a friend, you wouldn't do that. And that's where I was thinking that maybe he might have thought that was poisoned or in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Because he said just before drinking that he considers Daedalus his close friend, drinks it. And then wouldn't that be just the ultimate betrayal if, you know, the poison reacts and he falls down? Like, oh, but my friend, you know, betrayed me. But he doesn't. Daedalus is very loyal, and he does a good turn for Julian.
Mm-hmm.
After that, Lily is engaging with Julian in conversation, and it gets a bit, you know, buttons are pushed here and there, and Lily asks whether Julian wants her to move out of the house. You know, after doing that cock block move and betraying him in the previous episode, I would have thought that answer might be yes. But Julian, being the of utmost respect person that he is, allows her to stay in the house and says that it's her house as well. And she pushes to know where the ritual area is, because Cash kind of wanders in at that moment going like, we found them. We know where they are. And then says the location right in front of Lily when she pushes. And he also says that any human going to that area will be killed.
Mm-hmm.
Which immediately, like, you see this look on her face, like, light bulb. And so then Lily goes to Caitlin, hands her a check for $25,000 that will be given to anyone with information leading to the recovery of the baby.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you offer a reward, you don't do it in a pre-made check. You know, it's more like a commitment to give the money. You don't just give the check. But that might just be a change for television's sake. So they're talking about Julian and the relationship that they had, and Lily's talking about, oh, that was a long time ago. We're not longer together. That was a long time ago. And as they're drinking the wine, this red wine, Caitlin, you know, turns her back, and Lily drugs it. Lily drugs her wine. And being a Toreador, I also would have thought that she would have been able to do that with her mind, and just by her sheer will of force and persuasion, be able to make someone pass out, because she does that to victims when she drinks their blood. Why does she need to give her a substance to put her out?
You know what I would love to have seen leading up to this episode is just a bit of a flashback as well to Julian driving Goth out of town.
Ooh, that would have been nice.
Even if you had, like, maybe younger actors playing him, which wouldn't have made a lot of sense considering vampires don't age. But
yeah.
But still, you know, just do just like a little bit of a flashback compared to some of the drawn-out melodrama that we got with this episode.
Yeah, that would have definitely been nice, because it's mentioned that this is the second time he's come, you know, around, and he kicked him out of town, and there's not really any information past that.
Mm-hmm. True.
Not the method that he used, or the threat that he used to get him out of town, and was there any punishment for him coming around after that? It's not even stated.
No, it doesn't really seem like it.
So Lily is trying to set up Caitlin to find the baby. In essence, putting her in a situation to get killed. And so because the photos from the last episode didn't work, you know, Julian and her are still together, and she still has her job at the paper, even though it's a very inappropriate relationship. So Lily is finding a different way to get rid of Caitlin from the picture, even though Lily is no longer with Julian either. It's just more jealousy. It's jealousy just all the way around. You know, Julian was trying to balance two chicks. He couldn't do it. He lost both briefly, and now he only has Caitlin, and she is really pissed about that. And Lily asks her, point blank, you know, have you two made love? It's like, Caitlin calls her out for it being an inappropriate question.
Yeah.
Like, why would you have a drink with someone if you're not really close friends? You know, at most, they're good acquaintances. And then ask about their love life in such blatant, you know, inappropriateness, you know.
But they both want the D in the same way.
Yeah, yeah. He must be good. Yeah, he must be good. But Caitlin hasn't found that out yet. And Lily apologizes for asking such a steamy question.
Mm-hmm.
And then says,
not really
an
apology, though.
Huh?
Not really an apology. She's just the way she says it is just kind of like, oh, well, that's just the way I am, so you need to suck it up and deal with it.
Yeah. Sorry, not sorry. I really mean to make you uncomfortable because I'm here. Yeah, I wanna throw you off, but I don't really want to scare you away. I want you to keep me close, but I also want to torture you at the same time. It's the frenemy. It's the definition of a frenemy. So, you know, she drinks the wine, passes out, and whispering in her ear, Lily tells her the directions for where to find the baby, and then, you know, says to give the Nosferatu her regards as if, you know, that was ever going to happen,
mm-hmm.
and just sends her out into the world to find the baby, be a hero, and hopefully get killed.
Yes.
So, after that, you know, Julian has decided that he's going to handle Goth. He's decided that he's going to handle Goth, and there's just no bones about it. You know, that's why Daedalus gave him the wine, and this could be Julian's demise. You know, he has decided to, instead of having the baby be killed in the situation, that he's going to sacrifice himself on the altar. So, trade places
like
for the
baby. Like
a good
prince should.
Well, I mean, in my mind, it wouldn't actually work. You know, they're wanting a blood sacrifice of an innocent. And Julian is far from innocent, nor is he living. So, therefore, it's not really a sacrifice. He's already dead.
Yeah. But he's a pure of heart. Maybe like a baby? No. I mean, he's killed people. That doesn't even make sense. I completely take back what I just said.
he's not an innocent at all. It's more like he would be sacrificing his power, and that might be something, you know, to sacrifice the power instead of innocence. It's tempting, but it's not too tempting because they really want the baby. So, you know, Goth, the trade isn't accepted by Goth. You know, Goth is not going to accept it. And Caitlin, you know, being this kind of dazed, drugged position, I don't know what she was given, but she's moving on her feet, and she finds the lair. She sneaks into the lair of the Nosferatu and finds the baby. And Camilla actually is the one that talks to her about it. And I don't know why Caitlin wouldn't freak out at seeing, you know, a Nosferatu in person, but she instead feels comforted enough to relay this very deep, troubling portion of her life to Camilla. So Camilla says that a baby is very precious, and that, you know, babies are so precious because vampires can't have children. So there's that kind of coveted position that a baby is in.
Mm-hmm.
And Camilla relays that she's had 8 kids. So, you know, of course,
which is a little bit, a little strange, but,
huh?
I said it's a little bit strange considering that she's a Nosferatu now, and, you know, her previous human life, it doesn't, you just don't really think about it that way.
No, you don't, but, she had 8 children, 2 of which died in childbirth, which also goes back to the point in time that she was turned. It was not as advanced in medical technology, so that was pretty common.
Yeah.
And having big families meant that you could actually run the farm and your estates, and it was like free labor. And that's how, you know, that's why a lot of families had a lot of kids, because they needed a lot of hands. It was free, and they could do everything. So Caitlin tells her that at 17, she had a baby and that she gave it away under family pressure. So it wasn't that she had an abortion or whatnot, or was pressured to get an abortion, is that she was pressured to give away her baby.
Okay, yeah. Before I rewatched the episode, I thought Caitlin had had an abortion at the time.
That
I was...
would have been interesting to have in the 90s on television. Yeah.
Yeah, but and then the time just when I was watching the episodes back to back, I was about ready to watch this one. A certain order had come out from the White House about abortions. I'm not going to get into, but the that's what made me think of the episode. Going, wait a minute, we're about to start this episode. Didn't Caitlin have an abortion in the 90s? Dun dun dun.
Yeah. No, it's she had a baby that she gave up for adoption under family pressure, and you know she's 17, the same age as Ruth now, and so she's seeing this, seeing Ruth and how distraught she is over the loss of her child, and how it makes her feel over the loss of her own child that she voluntarily gave away. And so Camilla shows compassion for Caitlin and puts her to sleep, inserts this subliminal subconscious message that she's going to take the burdens off of Caitlin's shoulders. You know, mm-hmm. She doesn't have to live with this anymore, and then she'll forget everything that she's just talked about, forget all of this, and she will be right with ease over the situation. And that actually seems to really help Caitlin in the long run for just her mental stability and her emotional stability. But Camilla has this like soft spot for Caitlin and for the baby, you know, and when Julian convinces Camilla to accept his sacrifice instead of the baby's, they end up putting the baby in this the bassinet carrier that Jesse was picked up with, hanging from a tree, just like the Rockabye Baby story.
Yeah.
It was hanging from the tree boughs, this woven basket-ish bassinet carrier up off the ground, hanging from the trees. And Camilla is really very touching and loving with this baby. You know, she really, you know, wants the baby safe, you know. And so she cries the blood tears, and she takes one of her tears and she puts the drop of blood on the mouth of the baby. And Julian says that she'll grow up with a touch of the wild to her. And I thought that was pretty sweet. And, you know, Camilla, I think, was a very cool character. I really enjoyed this character.
She's a little bit better written than Goth.
Yes, yes. There's more depth to that. Mm-hmm. Goth is just more the just the two-dimensional character. I hate this. I want this. Go. And Camilla is like, I want this, but this is what we're going through, and this is my past, and I don't really want to do this, but I want the ends, but does that justify the means? And she decides, based on what Julian's logicked her into, that if she gives the baby away, then Goth will have no choice but to accept Julian in trade, and for Julian to be on the sacrificial altar. So she goes along with it. And, you know, Frank and Ruth end up finding the baby shortly thereafter because, of course, they're searching in the park.
Yeah, because the baby will still, of course, be there.
Well, you know, the last known whereabouts of the baby. And so they're still searching. And they find it. Ruth thanks profusely, you know, whatever's around. And just like, oh, thank you. I have my baby. And, so then we get into the major action of the episode is that fight. You know, I loved how they did it with that sound, as I mentioned before. It's like a dog fight. There's blood all over the place. Not a lot of gore, you know, but just like blood all over the mouth of Julian and all the cheek and you know, slashes on places. And what I found most surprising about how this fight started was that Julian puts down all of his weapons. You know, the whole thing started, Julian puts down all of his weapons at, like, the start of this whole debacle. And they end up fighting on Camilla's order, mm-hmm. almost like a duel, you know, where you have two people at opposite sides of the field, you know, turn and shoot. So Camilla raises her hand, and then when she puts down her hand, both parties just jump up into the air and attack one another. They you know, on those wires, they jump up, attack, and fall to the ground and just kind of wrestle on the ground for a little bit while the sound effects and the tearing and the blood is going, you know, places splattering everywhere. It's not a lot of blood, but it's done very well.
Yes.
And then he's Julian is like pinned on the rock on the altar. The knife is about to go towards Julian's head, and right above his head is the tiniest battle axe I've ever seen. Like, seriously, it's like a letter opener battle axe. But he ends up taking and putting the handle of the battle axe through Goth's chest. Yeah. Not the most effective of killing methods for a vampire, but, you know, a stake through the heart supposedly works.
Better than the phosphorus gun, which we've seen before.
Yeah, and it was mentioned in this episode that the phosphorus gun might not work because he is so powerful.
He's so old and powerful.
So
probably older than Daedalus.
Maybe. I know it was alluded to that he's more powerful than Daedalus right now, or at least equal to.
Yeah.
Based on the alchemy that Goth had done.
Mm-hmm. To make himself more super uber vampire-ish.
Yeah.
At the end of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the final episode, like the final season, they had like these uber vamps that kind of looked like Nosferatu popping up every 5 minutes, and they were like the most powerful vampires Buffy has ever faced. That's hence why they were called uber vamps, and there were like hundreds of thousands of them below Sunnydale. They were so powerful, like they broke Buffy's arm, and like they really beat the living crap, like beat the living crap out of her in one episode.
Jeez.
Yeah, like a really like brutal beatdown episode for Buffy. She takes a severe punishment in it. There is like one other episode where she fights like a super duper vamp, but only because this vamp hadn't been fed in quite a while. So it was like more savage than ever. And she didn't have her powers in it. Her powers were taken away by her watcher as a testament to a trial by fire on her 18th birthday.
Is this the storyline with the apocalypse ending? I never watched the full season.
Well, the uber vamp thing is like the end of the show.
Okay.
When Sunnydale was like caved into the Hellmouth. And then there was one other episode where Buffy fought like a super duper vampire. But it was even harder because this vampire hadn't been fed in a while and was like kind of a crazed killer. And whereas some vampires you can kind of reason with, but not really. And she didn't have her powers because it was again a trial by, you know, like a rite of passage to that she could survive an attack by a vampire without her powers. And if she does, then she's a true slayer. If she dies, then well, the next girl will get called upon. Oh, by the way, they use her mother as bait to draw her out. And it's like she is pissed at the Watchers Council, and Giles like goes against the Watcher Council because he didn't want to do it to begin with. At the end of the episode, Buffy is like got cuts and bruises and like, you know, just really messed up looking, and she's trying to like, you know, like clean herself off or whatever, and Giles like reaches behind her or whatever and takes the cloth out of her hand and dabs it in the water and sits down and starts rubbing her face off like a father to a daughter, and like the most touching, like just absolute, you know, tear-jerking moment I think on Buffy ever. Because she's at her, like, most beaten down. She just told the Watcher Council to F off. You know, she's done working for them. She's going to be a slayer on her own. And then, you know, Giles, like, feels partially responsible, takes it upon himself to continue being her watcher by helping her clean her wounds and her, you know, while she's, like, suffering in pain.
That's sweet.
It's so touching. It's so touching. But that's just another example of fighting, like, a super-duper uber vamp, which is kind of like what Goth is, which is why Julian has to soup up. So,
yeah.
Then we get to, like, the, I mean, they...
The yum portion of the episode.
Yes, the yum portion of the episode.
Yeah, so after Caitlin wakes up, because Julian, you know, basically takes her back home since she was put to sleep by Camilla. He takes her back home, puts her in a bed. She wakes up like, what are you doing here? Didn't remember a thing of what happened. The only thing that she remembers is that she thinks that she knew where the baby was, and that was about it. You know, but the side effect of Camilla's subliminal, subconscious, post-hypnotic suggestions is that she has now overcome that hump of emotional distress that was keeping her from being intimate with Julian.
Yes. And
so she's like all honesty.
Yes.
Like,
it's the romance episode. It's the romance lovemaking.
Yeah, yeah. And the very, very last scene, it's hilarious to me anyway. The very last scene, like, they are starting to intertwine, you know, that embrace of, you know, coitus going to happen imminently.
Oh, you mean from the opening sequence that we've seen in every single episode?
Well, I mean, this is the closing episode. So he actually does have his shirt off.
But in the opening of every single episode, we see the two of them.
Oh, yeah, in the opening credits.
The opening credits, we see them making love every single episode. So you knew that was coming.
Course,
back in episode two.
can't be such a tease all this time.
No. It's like one of the two last scenes that we get to see before the series ends. The other one being Archon standing in the garden with his arms out.
Oh, yeah.
That comes next week.
So, you know, this coitus is about to happen. The camera pulls back, and it pulls back to the porch, kind of like a French door-ish type of door.
Mm-hmm.
No curtains obscuring anything. So the viewer is looking into this scene as if it's a peeping Tom. Like, I found that, like, kind of a little unsettling, the whole pulling back, and then you're watching them through the glass of the porch, the door to her bedroom. It's almost like you're spying on their intimate moment. And I know that it's a trick to get the audience to feel that it's this, like, very hush, private moment.
Mm-hmm.
But it personally kind of made me feel a little bit like a creeper.
Did you feel like a voyeur?
Yeah. It's like I'm peeking in on this imminent sex moment, and, you know, all I can think about is, oh man, I would be such a creeper if I was doing this in real life. You know, this peeping Tom peeping in on their sex. That's the last thing before the credits. The camera pulls back, and
we get a little taste of the juicy lovemaking of the show. The most uncomfortable thing ever to do in any TV or movie is to try to have sex or make love.
Well, yeah, because you've got 20 or 30 people looking at you,
and you're also you're also pretty much almost naked or fully naked, depending on the comfortability of the two actors. Usually they're wearing like underwear or something on the, you know, on the bottom half, but come on, you're embraced up against this like completely half naked woman. You cannot tell me that you're not poking her by accident.
Yeah, you might take a bit of a taste.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but I've talked to enough actors who've been like, it's a little uncontrollable, but we don't discuss it when it's happening.
Yeah.
You know, we usually move the sheet back over, the pillow back over, or, you know, like, we reset or whatever, and we're staying in bed, so I don't have to worry about getting up and being, like, at half mass. And I'm like, really? And I've had the same thing from female actresses who come on Radio Horror being like, oh, yeah, the lovemaking scene is just, like, ridiculous, or it's, like, all you're feeling is this, like, you know, dry humping.
It's very unsexy in the moment.
Yes, definitely.
That's one thing about filming bodies. You know, I've done a lot of photography from, like, the model side, and I was also trained as a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
But human bodies, because they are bags of mostly water,
mm-hmm.
the way that a body will sit on a bed, on a chair, whatnot, when you don't have clothes, you can see where the flesh kind of pours out from the pressure points. And that's kind of difficult to maneuver around. So when you're setting up a scene like this, you have the actors in position, and you have to adjust them so that maybe they're holding themselves a little bit more upright on an elbow, or there's a cushion or a riser underneath a hip so the ass doesn't look squished. It's a lot of things that you have to do in order to get the flesh to actually behave in a physically attractive way. Because if you really take a look at, like, amateur porno, it's not really beautiful. You know, it's great for being passionate, maybe, you know, or awkward, you know, if you're into that.
When you say passionate porno, are you talking about, like, the Red Shoe Diaries and Showtime kind of Cinemax crap?
I'm talking more porno.
Oh, more, okay, actual porno, okay.
Actual
porno, yeah. Okay. I wasn't sure if you're talking about... See, because there's actual porno where they show penetration, and then softcore porn where you don't see penetration.
No. I'm talking about, like, if you're looking at actual porno, it's not beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, the flesh goes kind of everywhere.
Yeah. I've had enough interviews with adult film stars to definitely admit that.
Yeah.
and so why they eventually leave the industry to pursue, like, a lot of nude modeling work because it's the only thing they can get, unfortunately. But so sometimes they make it into a career. Former guest of the show told me that she has found a nice career being the nude body in a lot of horror movies, low-budget horror movies, because she doesn't mind being nude. She doesn't want to do porn anymore, but she still doesn't mind being nude in a horror movie.
Hey,
so she gets a lot of work that way, and I was just like, that is an amazing career if you really want it. And she's like, I don't mind it. It pays very well. And there are a lot of actresses who don't want to be nude, but I'm more than willing to be, like, their stand-in or the girl who's going to have a nude scene.
Hey, you know, it pays the bills.
It pays the bills, yeah, so...
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty much it for this episode of Kindred the Embraced, Bad Moon Rising. Which I'm kind of surprised that we never got a the song Bad Moon Rising.
Licensing.
Yes, probably. we got licensing. It in American Werewolf in London, but not in this episode.
Yeah, there wasn't actually a lot of music in this episode.
No, and sometimes that can be really expensive, and sometimes it also really hurts a lot of TV series that have music in it when they come to DVD or Netflix or streaming websites. There was a TV series called Werewolf, the series, which has a lot of copywritten music in it, and it has been delayed like 3 times being released on DVD because of the copywritten music. I don't think it'll ever see light of day. We haven't heard anything about it in many, many years. Almost a decade now was the last time we heard anything about a DVD release of Werewolf, the series, which was a USA series starring... Oh, shoot. The name is now escaping me. Hold on. I'm really tired.
Do a Google search.
Yeah, no, I'm on the wrong IMDb episode for Kindred the Embraced. Hold on. This is why we edit. Yes. Brian Thompson was the villain on this show.
Oh.
Yes.
He's a villain in this one too.
Yes. So he's played a werewolf, a vampire, an alien, a ghoul. He's got rage. He's got much range as an actor, but yes, he was. If I'm correct, and I look
kind
at his
like
IMDb,
Ron Perlman.
Huh?
Kind of like Ron Perlman.
Oh yeah, totally.
He does a lot of monsters.
Yeah, and by the way, Brian Thompson is still acting today. He's in nothing that I will have ever watched. It's probably all directed DVD schlock. His career is extensive. Yes, he was in 5 episodes of Werewolf, playing the same character, Nicholas Remy. He was the guy who turns the main character into a werewolf. So he's like the recurring bad guy.
Uh-huh.
Yes, he's in the pilot and then in 4 other episodes. He is the recurring bad guy. However, when his character is killed off, it's revealed that he is not the originator of the werewolf virus, and the main character has to continue to find him.
Yeah.
Yes. So,
that's how a virus can stop, you know.
And that's how a TV series logic. That's how a TV series can continue. You kill the guy who turned you into a werewolf, no more show. Unfortunately, the show was canceled after, I think, one or two seasons, and it never had a definite ending. But the episodes itself are very much like The Incredible Hulk. It's like an on-the-road heroes type of journey show.
So, does it have that sad music at the end?
Too? Yes, yes, yes. It had great special effects, too. I remember a lot of people commented how the special effects of Werewolf the series were fantastic. I actually had the main actor from this show on my show as one of my first guests ever. He's currently playing... his name is John J. York, and he was actually he's been on All My Children or General Hospital as Max Scorpio for the last like 600 episodes.
What a name!
Yes, I couldn't believe it. When I contacted him to have him on my show, his agent couldn't believe which show I wanted him on for, and he was just like, "Some guy wants to have you on for." He told me, my agent called me and he said, "Some guy in Massachusetts wants to have you on for Werewolf the series," and he was like, "What?" Wait, this isn't a soap opera interview? He's like, "No, this is about Werewolf," and he was like, "I will totally do that interview."
Yeah.
So when I had him on the show, man, did people tune in, because they could not figure out, like, why the hell do you have John J. York on the show? Because, again, for the last several years, since 1990, he has been on General Hospital.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a career, man.
Yeah. 1990 to 2017? Yeah. Well, that is, again, all the time we have here tonight. Don't forget to check out our Facebook page, The Dead TV Podcast, as well as me on Twitter at ChrisDSAV. And if you feel so inclined, please donate to our Patreon. You can also check out Mr. Zeneca at
ElegantlyKinky.com.
And don't forget to please leave a rating for us on iTunes and a review. Yes. If you cannot do that on iTunes, at least share the link to our website, RadioHorror.com, where you can listen to this and all the other episodes of the Dead TV Podcast.
And please, we love all your comments. You know, if there's something we said that was wrong, please correct us.
Yes, definitely.
That's the purpose of the internet here.
Yes, absolutely. And once again, thank you to Jess O'Lantern for supplying us with our theme song for the episode, which you can hear again once again once we leave. I am Dr. Chris.
And I am Mr. Zeneca.
And have a good night.